us at englishradio@irib.ir, englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Pro-Palestinians in France gathered the day after what was reported to be the first peaceful night in Gaza in 6 months. The reason? The night before, Iran launched a historic missile retaliation against Israel, which prevented Tel Aviv from continuing their attempt at genocide and ethnic cleansing. At the demonstration, there was widespread approval, support, and even gratitude and admiration for Tehran's counterattack against the unprecedented bombing assassination at an embassy.
I'm not an anti-Semite, and as a Muslim, I want us all to live together peacefully, but I see Iran's attack as something good on their part. Iran is the only major country which has had the courage to attack Israel and defend Palestine's innocent civilians. This war can easily stop if Israel can finally realize that they are attempting a genocide.
Those who are occupiers do not have the right to legitimate defense, but Iran does have the right, and they used it to defend Gaza as well. Israel bombs and assassinates people constantly. How can people forget about what Israel has done?
Protesters contrasted Iran's actions with those of the French foreign minister last week. After mentioning the possibility of placing sanctions on Israel over Gaza, he immediately backtracked the next day in front of Parliament.
The French government is quite the accomplice in the genocide that Israel is waging right now. Why aren't there any sanctions despite all these deaths? And when France talks so much about defending human rights, it's simply shameful.
French forces claim to have contributed to Israel's defense. In a major blow to perpetual Israeli hopes of escalating the violence, Washington has already refused to join any potential Israeli attack on Iran. It's uncertain if the cycle of Israeli assassination and Iranian retaliation is now concluded, but Israel has already returned to indiscriminate bombing and mass murder in Gaza, despite 6 months of global outrage, the murder of 34,000 Palestinians, and 76,000 injuries.
Will Israel pursue an even wider war? Will more Arab nations be inspired to join the cause of defending Gaza? What's certain is that many are happy that, for one night at least, the guns aimed at Gaza's civilians finally fell silent. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pakistanis are showing staunch solidarity with the Iranian retaliatory strikes against the Israeli-occupied territories. Social media platforms overflow with messages of congratulations for Iran's effective response to Israel's atrocities, hailing Iran as a courageous champion of Muslim states willing to confront a Zionist regime, especially following months of atrocities against the Gaza Strip.
We are proud of Iran for taking a stand against Israel's aggression. The Palestinians have been suffering for decades, and it's time someone took action to protect them. Iran's attack shows that they won't tolerate the oppression any longer.
I fully support Iran's decision to strike back against Israel. The Palestinians have been living under siege for decades, and it's high time someone stood up for them. Iran's actions give hope to oppressed people everywhere.
The Pakistani government has echoed both the sentiments of its citizens and voiced grave concerns over escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Islamabad underscored the Israeli blockade of Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the recent wave of tensions, emphasizing the urgent need for international intervention to prevent further escalations in the region.
Iran has done the right thing, legally and morally, because Iran has retaliated against Israeli unwarranted aggression and attack on Iranian diplomatic installation in Damascus. And that was a violation of UN Charter and international law. So what Iran has done is the right thing. They have responded in kind, and they have taken the battle to the aggressor, and they have hit Israel.
The people of Pakistan emphasize the urgent need for global intervention to halt the escalation of conflict in the region and call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Iran's attack on Israeli-occupied territories has garnered widespread support from Pakistanis, particularly due to their perceived alignment with the plight of people in Gaza. The warm reception of Tehran's operation by the Pakistani nation highlights its desire for a more assertive response to Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and as the moment as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba. 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this community, this Jewish community in France, has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views.
In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident. Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kiev, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the Constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
La.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work, and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children, and there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23rd, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. I would like to present a short history of these negotiations. Our negotiations with the Americans are, in fact, different from our negotiations with P5 plus 1. The Americans themselves asked for these negotiations, and their proposals date back to the time of the 10th administration. So the negotiations with the Americans began before the arrival of the current administration. They made a request and chose an intermediary. one of the honorable personalities in the region came to Iran and met with me. He said that the American president had called him, asking him to help. The American president said to him that they want to resolve the nuclear matter with Iran and that they would lift sanctions. Two fundamental points existed in his statements. One was that he said they would recognize Iran as a nuclear power. Second, he said that they would lift sanctions in the course of 6 months. Through that intermediary, he asked us to negotiate with them and to resolve the matter. I said to that honorable intermediary that we do not trust the Americans and their statements. He said, "Try it once more," and we said, "Very well, we will try it this time as well." This was how negotiations with the Americans began.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to raise a point for the attention of officials. Of course, everyone should pay attention to it. In global challenges, reason dictates that we take two arenas into consideration. One is the arena of reality and action. So one arena is the arena of reality and action, which is the main arena. In the arena of reality and action, the official who is trying to pursue his activities creates certain assets and resources. This is one arena. Another is the arena of diplomacy and policy. In the arena of diplomacy and policy, this official turns the assets into a concession and national advantage for his country. If one is empty-handed in the first arena, one cannot do anything in the second arena either. You should have an advantage and an asset in the first arena, the arena of action, reality, and field work.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
A sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the skies over the Zionist-occupied territories were lit up by hundreds of Iranian drones and missiles late on Saturday night and early Sunday morning. Settlers ran for cover while natives looked up to the skies with hope, and people in the region celebrated the beginning of Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Israeli entity. Well, stay with us as we look at what it all means, Iran's retaliatory attack on the Zionist regime, and now what's likely to happen on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Bethlehem, New York, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter. Out of London, historian and author Shivan Mahendraraja.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off I'm going to start it off in London, actually, with Shivan. And the Israeli regime being an invincible power has been a narrative that the Western hegemonic front, along with the regime, has propagated for decades. And, of course, the resistance front has been destroying the narrative for years now, from Hezbollah to Hamas and now Iran, with its retaliatory strikes inside of the occupied territories. Your thoughts about how this has affected the Zionist regime, actually losing this narrative and understanding that it's definitely not invincible.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm actually honored to also be with Scott Ritter on the show. So I actually think that this is really an eye-opener for Israelis, and I mean just ordinary Israelis as much as it is for the government, because this narrative of invincibility has been built up for many years, but also the younger generation has not experienced war. They have not had to go into air raid shelters, nor have to hear air raid warnings like their parents and grandparents did up through the Yom Kippur War. So this raid of something like 185 drones, some 110 ballistic missiles that came in from different parts. So all of Israel was lit up with air raid warnings, about 750 air raid warnings, I believe. I could be wrong. But anyway, a lot of people are going into shelter. They were panicking even before this. And now that sense of security is gone, because this is actually a very successful raid. Now, there are people who are saying, oh, well, only about three or four missiles hit, everything else was shot down. Actually, no, because what they did was to overwhelm and to confuse the air defense systems of Israel, plus all the people who were helping Israel, Jordan, U.S., France, Britain, and the U.S., of course. And the targets were hit, what they wanted to strike. Some of the other missiles and drones were shot down, but it was at a huge cost, not just financial cost, but in terms of the interceptors that were used. They cannot keep doing this if they want to escalate with Iran, and Iran keeps launching wave after wave after wave, day after day. At some point, Israel is going to run out of missiles, because these things just can't be manufactured overnight, and there is a limited amount of stock, and the U.S. has to hold on to some of the stock that they have for their own purposes, as well as all the other things that they want to do in terms of, you know, a war with China or in case NATO needs them. So anyway, I think this is quite successful. And it was what I call a reconnaissance in force, by the way, in the sense is that they use a fair amount of force, but not overwhelming force. And I think the Iranian IRGC airspace learned a lot about Israel's air defenses from what happened yesterday as to what can get through, what Israel can throw back up at them. So that if this escalates, there is a lot that they can use.
Okay, say with me, Shivan. Sorry to interrupt. Let me get Scott in on this conversation. Well, Scott, I mean, your assessment of Iran being able to penetrate the Israeli airspace and several layers of its defense mechanisms.
Well, first of all, I want to echo everything that your guest Shivan just said. He's 100% correct. This was an extraordinarily successful attack by Iran on Israel. We need to understand, first of all, the objective of the attack. It was to prove a point that Iran could, in fact, strike Israel at a time and place of its choosing. Iran made a decision, I believe, in this attack to limit the scope and scale of the attack so as to not give Israel a reason to retaliate to the Iranian retaliation. The Iranians wanted to demonstrate a capability, put Israel and its allies, including the United States, on notice that Iran possesses a viable deterrence, and that Iran will strike those who strike Iran, and that the price that will be paid will be heavy, and therefore nations should think twice before attacking Iran. And I think that this objective was achieved. We see that by the United States pressuring Israel not to launch an attack, and Israel not pushing back very hard, because Israeli officers, you know, you talked about this narrative, this concept of Israeli invincibility. Israeli officers, and I've worked with them in the past, are very professional. They're very realistic, and they know what the truth is. They have, for the past 2 years, conducted war games where they exercise a scenario that has Israel being attacked simultaneously by Hezbollah, by Syria, by Iran. And a key aspect of their thinking going in, of the calculations they make, is the effectiveness of their air defense systems. And you have politicians in Israel who give high credence to Israeli air defense. And you have the military that's more balanced, more realistic. They know for certain now that their air defense will not stop an Iranian attack, that if Iran was to launch a full-scale attack, combined with Hezbollah, Syria, and others, that they would overwhelm Israeli air defense and inflict devastating, if not lethal, damage to the Israeli state. And so this is the impact. The Israelis now know for a fact that should they ever attack Iran, the consequences to Israel will be devastating. And this is the element of deterrence that Iran wanted to establish.
Okay. Well, speaking of that element of deterrence, Shivan, do you think in general that with Iran's attack on the Israeli regime, that there is now a different paradigm which has been established, and that the Israelis realize that they will have to answer, Tehran will make them answer, perhaps even inside the occupied territories, for any type of aggression that they may initiate against Iran?
Yes. What has happened before is that since Iran was practicing strategic patience, there were many commentators and probably some, you know, in intelligence services and the military as well, who probably, you know, in Europe, U.S., Israel, who thought Iran was scared, that they were afraid to actually hit Iran, to hit Israel, but they would only use quote-unquote proxies to do the work for them. What happened today shows that Iran is more than willing to strike into Israel. And the announcement that the era of strategic patience is over is, I think, a very big announcement, because now what they are saying out of Tehran is basically, you hit us anywhere on our soil or in Syria, we will strike you at home. No more of this quote-unquote proxy business. And that, I think, should be a very, very strong lesson. But I think there's also the other factor which I would like to add in here, which also gets into the deterrence, is that now some of this information is very preliminary as to how many were launched, how many were shot down, what happened. But there is one good estimate out there that says only about 50% of Iran's ballistic missiles were actually shot down. And this should scare not just the Israelis, but the Americans as well, because the systems used by the Israelis for the most part are American. Now think about what's happened, what would happen if Israel does manage to create a regional war, which is what Netanyahu wants, which means the United States gets involved. Now, Israel has a very thick air defense blanket, but some of the American bases, certainly in Syria and in Iraq, but also in some of these other countries like Qatar, don't have that kind of air defense capability. And if Iran can get through to Israel's air defense, Israel's air defenses, they will be able to overwhelm American air defenses in Syria, Iraq, Qatar, UAE, and Kuwait. And that should scare the Americans into thinking, you know, Israel, don't do anything stupid.
Okay. Well, Scott, as you said earlier, Iran initiated a calculated and limited response against military sites. Now, why do you think that Iran gave a controlled response? And also, I'd like to look at the example that Iran is showing by not attacking civilian areas, but only military targets. I mean, much opposite of what, unfortunately, we have been witnessing the last 6.5 months in the genocide in Gaza.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to point out that Iran did not initiate the sequence of events that led to this, to the need for this action. That Iran is responding to irresponsible and illegal behavior on the part of Israel. Behavior that isn't just limited to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but has extended to Israeli involvement in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists on Iranian soil, etc. Your other guest, Mr. Shervin, talked about Iran's policy of strategic patience, but it's more than that. Let's look at what Iran's been doing diplomatically in the last year or so. One, normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia. That's a very big step that shows that Iran is not posturing itself for regional confrontation, but rather regional stability. Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has joined BRICS, which means that the Iranian focus is not on military aggression, but economic co-prosperity, economic cooperation. Iran has been struggling under international sanctions for decades now, and they are finally seeing a pathway to where they can look at normal economic relations with a good percentage of the world. Iran's not going to throw this away in an irresponsible military behavior. Iran is not looking for a fight. But Iran also can't stand by and allow Israel to carry out an attack of this nature, because left unpunished, Israel would just be more emboldened to do bigger and bigger acts. So Iran had no choice but to carry out an act of this nature. But this action was designed not to be decisive. I think people need to understand that. This was a deliberate act of constraint on the part of Iran, because they are not looking for a war. They are looking for peace. They are looking for stability, but they had no choice but to reestablish a policy, a posture of deterrence. And they've done that. It was a very calculated action on the part of Iran, both in terms of how they did this. What nation broadcasts the fact that they're going to attack another nation 5 hours in advance? And yet that's what Iran did, by sending out in a very publicized manner its loud Shahid drones. They told Israel, here we come. You have 5 hours to move your critical material away from stuff. Look at what they targeted. They didn't saturate an airbase. They hit one or two runways. They hit some empty warehouses. They let Israel know that Iran can look at a point on a map and hit that point on the map. But they also let Israel know that Iran deliberately avoided the high-value targets, deliberately avoided the places where they could generate high numbers of casualties. Iran was not looking to punish Israel. Iran was simply looking to put Israel on notice that if Israel continues this behavior, Israel will be punished. But Iran is not looking for a fight. Iran is not looking for a war. Iran is looking for regional peace and prosperity that, you know, is engendered by stability, political stability, not the instability of conflict.
Right. Well, what about that, Shivan? You heard what Scott said, that Iran is not looking for a fight. But when we look at the reactions, whether we're talking about, you're in London, Rishi Sunak, and what he said, for example, after the Iran's retaliatory attacks, and saying that, again, the UK stands with Israel and condemned the Iranian attacks. And, of course, we saw the same thing coming from other various Western countries. Your thoughts on that? Because this continual scenario that this Western hegemonic front has tried to show as Iran basically being the bad guy, the terrorist, and of course then the Israelis being the defenders of democracy. I mean, do you think that we're transitioning, that more and more people understand that lie now?
I think so. I think, you know, what has happened over the last 6 months has changed a lot of minds all across the world. Even people who were formerly, you know, very pro-Israel have turned against Israel given what has happened. There are, for example, some very strong conservative voices like, I think, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, who have actually been critical. And I think the narrative is changing. People like Rishi Sunak and that EU person, von der Leyen, or whatever they call her. I mean, you know, people are just tired of them. I actually don't even read their tweets or their stuff because it's the same thing that's recycled. And I think this is true for millions of people around the world, that they just see these Western leaders as hypocrites who talk about democracy, civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, but they don't actually exercise it. And I think these 6 months of Gaza has exposed that. So I don't know who listens to these people anymore, except those who are deeply devoted to one particular narrative and will not change their minds. I mean, you see lots of Jews. Like, you know, I was home in New York in October, and there were lots of Jews. I'm a New Yorker. I'm living here. But I saw lots of Jews out there protesting, you know, what is going on in Gaza. And this is really one of the things that the media do not want to talk about, is that the Jewish view of Israel is not monolithic. And you can see that in the major Western cities and capitals as well. So I don't know who Rishi Sunak is trying to convince, except, you know, like what we call preaching to the choir, maybe.
Right. Well, looking at this Western hegemonic front, Scott, we saw that last night during Iran's retaliation attack, that France, UK, US, Jordan were all involved in actually trying to shoot down Iranian drones. Your take on that? I mean, what does that say about the Israeli regime itself? Does it mean that it does not have the capacity to take on Iran at all or alone? And what does that do for their own self-confidence in being that they could not do this alone?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that Israel has war gamed out this scenario. And so they know the data. And they know what their saturation point is when it comes to their air defense ceasing to be effective against incoming targets. The other thing is the United States, France, Great Britain, they are part of this game of keeping Israel out of a broader war with Iran. And so it was in their interests to shoot down these targets. Iran wanted them to shoot down these targets. Iran sent overwhelming force that required the United States, Great Britain, France to put up their airplanes, to bring in their air defense, to come to the assistance of Israel, to mitigate the potential damage that could be done. And it was also a signal to all parties that, you know, Israel cannot stand alone. And therefore, it's in the interest of these parties to keep Israel out of a broader war, because in order to save Israel, they will have to be involved. But the same missiles that hit targets in Israel with precision accuracy can hit a British base in Cyprus. They can hit a French base. They can hit American installations in the Middle East. All of these nations now know that Iran has a capability that can hurt them in a time of conflict. And so this was a sort of this act of grand theater where Iran and the United States, they wrote a script, because the United States did not want, the United States knew that Iran had to strike. They understood the political reasoning behind it. They didn't want Iran to launch an overwhelming attack, and they let Iran know that. And Iran, not wanting a broader war, replied by sending enough force to send a message, but not too much, so that the United States could write a script that had its aircraft, its ships coming to the assistance of Israel, demonstrating friendship at the same time that Joe Biden picks up the phone, tells Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in an attack against Israel. So we're friends under certain circumstances, but the friendship is not limitless. This is, again, part of the script that Iran was shaping. I think the Iranians deserve far more credit diplomatically as well, that this is not just a military victory. This is a diplomatic achievement of some note.
All right. And last question, Shivan, we only have like a minute of time, but there were videos being shown last night, Palestinians celebrating. Gazans are saying it was the first time that there was no buzzing of drones over their heads. And also Palestinians in the West Bank even approaching the, trying to tear down the apartheid wall. Let's talk in general about what could it mean? I mean, Iran has penetrated Israeli airspace, but if the Muslim countries were truly independent and united, what could that mean for the Palestinians?
Well, I think there was a great deal of cheering going on from Muslim countries. And I saw comments from Pakistanis. I actually tweeted something from the Taliban where they were actually praying for success.
Well, I'm mainly talking about the Muslim countries right on side of the Palestinian territories.
Oh, right. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's kind of difficult because, I mean, you know, their rulers are very much in terms on the side of the United States, and they will do what the United States wants them to do. So I'm not quite sure how much benefit there will be for the people, even though they will privately cheer, and I'm sure Jordanians and Lebanese and so, and Saudis and so on may have been cheering for Iran, but how that will benefit the Palestinian people is very difficult, because governments are not going to be supporting the Palestinian people.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Scott Ritter, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer out of New York, Shivan Mahendraraja, historian and author out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight right here at Press TV.